As this morning. This is the meeting of the Texas Health Services Authority, and it will now come to order. Ms. Neighbors, please take roll call for attendance.
Annie.
Here.
Ms. Hartman.
Here.
Mr. Jason Hill.
Present.
Here.
Dr. Wright.
Here.
Here.
I'm here.
Here.
Ms. Rodriguez.
I'm here.
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 Thank you. With a quorum being present, I call this meeting of the Board of Directors of the Texas Health Services Authority to order at 10:14. I'm Shannon Calhoun, Chair of the Board, and I would like to welcome the board members and guests as we start our work today. I think it's always helpful to review our stated purpose as described in the THSA Enabling Statute, Chapter 182 of the Texas Health and Safety Code. The THSA is established to promote, implement, and facilitate the voluntary and secure electronic exchange of health information. The THSA accomplished this purpose through the HIE program, known as HIE Texas, and its Privacy and Security Certification program, known as Secure Texas. Members, our first item today is an update from THSA's CEO, George Gooch, on health information exchange services. Mr. Gooch, could you please brief our members on this item?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And my apologies, I should have put this in the notes. Just a reminder for today that due to some servicing that's going on around the Capitol, we only have audio recording for the day. This is not video recording, as you see by the big red off-air stickers on the cameras, but keeping that in mind, if you could please, if you have a comment, please say your name before making the comment. That'll be easier for people to follow along, and also remember to, you know, push the little red button so the microphone is on, because that is what captures your voice. It will not be captured if you do not push that. So just, you know, tiny reminder as we move forward today. With that, if you would turn to slide number 7 in your presentation materials, we'll walk through an update on our current status of HIE Texas services. So what you see here before you is four services, and one of those we are currently in development, and that is the Emergency Department Event Notification System. This is what we are currently under contract with Texas Medicaid to build the infrastructure for, and we'll provide a more specific update on this as we move forward. The second item is the Patient Unified Lookup System for emergencies. This is very much in the planning stage at this point. We have given updates on it in the past, but as we will discuss further in the meeting today, this is part of the state HIT plan that's attached to the Medicaid 1115 waiver. So this is, we do know that the state is planning around incorporating this system in partnership with the THSA. So much more to come on that as we move forward. The next two are still, you know, a couple steps out beyond Eden and then Pulse. And one is the resurrection of query-based bidirectional health information exchange services. This is very much the service that we started with under our prior platform from 2013 through the end of 2017. And it was for healthcare providers participating in health information exchange at the local level. We tied our local HIEs together and then provided gateways for them to exchange data through the eHealth Exchange and through care quality networks. We have received interest in resurrecting this service, and also bidirectional query-based HIE is alluded to in the state health IT plan. So it is something that we need to start discussing and planning about, you know, the viability of that moving forward and how we get to that next stage. And then the final one is public health reporting. And this is something that we've been planning on working on exploring with our public partners at the Department of State Health Services. Legislation was passed in 2015, House Bill 2641, that specifically allowed this public health reporting to occur via health information exchange. So since that time, we have switched platforms. We're building a new platform, but we do very much believe that we can leverage the current platform that we are building for Eden could be used for public health reporting as well. So that's just kind of a high-level roadmap of current services, where we're at, future planned services, but this will very much lay the groundwork. This is very high level in just one slide, but there will be a lot more planning and input from stakeholders and from the board as we move forward with any one of these. With that, I'm happy to take any questions that anyone has at this time on them.
This is Emily Hartman. George, I know you're in the very beginning stages, but for the final two, bidirectional and public health reporting, do you have any thoughts on specific use cases or sustainability models that you're considering?
Right. So very good question. On the query-based HIE, essentially the first time that we did this, we had built a system that was very much designed for both the public and private sectors to use. But essentially what we were doing for those first couple of years, it was operating just in the private sector. We were connecting our local HIEs together and to national networks. And that was very challenging, specifically because, I never remember the exact statistic, it's something like 90 or 95% of all healthcare is local. When you have a sore throat, you find the best ENT or general practitioner that you can drive to. You don't go to the best one in the state. So what that system, when it operates just in the private sector, it's really solving what we call an edge use case. And that is that 5 to 10% of the time that patients are seeking care outside of referral patterns that they live within. It may even be more, slightly more than 5 to 10% in a state like Texas, because specifically we have the Texas Medical Center and things like MD Anderson in Houston. So the use case might be that you go check in with your GP in the Austin or DFW or San Antonio area, and they refer you to Houston, and that data would exchange through our state-level network. Now, as we're moving forward and working, you know, with the state and as part of this state HIT plan, there will be development of much more specific use cases about how that would operate. So there will be a lot of planning going into that, and we're, like you said, we're still very much at the beginning phase, but we're not going to do, you know, build it first and see if they come. There will be a lot of planning and use case development and sustainability models behind that. As for the public health reporting, really it's just, I think we have some low-hanging fruit, good opportunity here that a lot of stakeholders, the whole would like to utilize the benefit of the network of networks model that we're employing, which is there are requirements for hospitals, physicians, and others to report data to certain registries maintained by the Department of State Health Services, such as the Cancer Registry, ELR, the Communicable Disease Registry, and MTRAC, or Immunization Registry. So the idea is that if they could report to those registries, and ideally, you know, we get to bi-directional health information exchange with those registries as well, then they're building one interface, because interfaces cost money. But if you want to participate in HIE and you separately have to report and build a separate interface to the state for that, then you're duplicating efforts. So if we can leverage this infrastructure that we're putting in place at the state level, then, you know, that would be very ideal. It would be a use case and a model that I believe the public sector can really get behind. Any other comments, questions, or thoughts? Okay. With that, we'll move on to the next section of our update on HIE Texas services, and that is our implementation metrics. If you'll turn to slide 9, and these implementation metrics are currently for development of the HIE connectivity project, which we often interchange the Eden project as the name with. So these are the milestones that we have with the Health and Human Services Commission for development of the state-level infrastructure, all the way from starting off a project kickoff to development of the data transport mechanism, doing sample file deliveries, deploying within the test environment, deploying the master patient index in the test environment, and then eventually doing a test from end to end in the test environment of exchange of that data. And then milestone number 8 that we also refer to as the capstone is once we have completed those milestones 1 through 7 and showed that we have moved from the test environment into the production environment. So if you will turn to your next slide, slide number 10, you'll see a visual representation of where we are at on each of these milestones. So across the top of this slide, you'll see target completion dates. And then moving horizontally, you'll see the milestone numbers, which correlate to the numbers on the previous slide. We have completed, actually, I'm very happy to report, we have completed 7 of those 8 milestones officially yesterday. So after we sent out the board materials, we have actually completed milestone 7. And the reason that this was gray with the still the green check mark is we had actually completed all of the work internally, but we had not yet set up the web demonstration to show our counterparts at HHSC that it was complete and proved to them that it worked. We have done that now. So essentially, what we are, our next step is to move all of those test environment deployments into the production environment, and we are currently working on that. And the reason you see the last target completion date says 9:30 plus is just because I couldn't quite fit any more space on this slide. My apologies. But we are currently targeting the end of the year to move into the production environment. Any questions, comments, or thoughts on where we are on the, and just a reminder, this is milestones associated with build out of the infrastructure. Some of the next steps would be working with local health information exchanges to connect them and working with the data subscribers, such as our Medicaid MCOs, to receive data through them on the other end. And that's really going to happen in lockstep with moving into the production environment. So we'll have metrics on those as we move forward, but this is just the milestones and benchmarks against building out the core infrastructure.
Kenneth James, I just had a question. So did that demo come with an approval from HHSC?
So very good question. They verbally approved it yesterday and then requested that I send an email so we could document that. And I sent it right towards the end of the day yesterday. And I'll check. But I see Todd back there. He's kind of nodding his head, and so we'll just put that down as the record as a definite yes. It's one of the benefits of having audio only. They did say that they were happy with the demonstration, but they do need to just affirmatively in writing state it, and I very much anticipate that's going to happen. Yes, Eric Heflin.
Thank you. Just to elaborate just a tiny bit further, so the demonstration itself, what it actually showed was the system working end-to-end completely in the validation environment. So we received an HL7 message simulating what a local HIE other source would provide to us. We processed it. We patient matched it correctly, created an outbound rule, and actually created an outbound alert. So it actually was end-to-end success in a test environment.
Basically the same thing that I said. So unless there are any other questions or comments on build out of the infrastructure, we can move on to slide 11. And that is issues that we still need to resolve before moving into the production environment. So we like to be very transparent and don't want to just fill you up with slides that have green check marks on them and say everything is 100% good all of the time. And these aren't problems. These are still just things that we need to figure out in partnership with HHSC and with our local HIE stakeholders. So one of those is Master Patient Index. And we're going through the exact process of what the data sources will be for that master patient index and how we fine-tune that master patient index to ensure that we have the absolute highest match rates for patients. The next is, as we alluded to earlier, is onboarding of local HIEs and other data sources. And we would need to go through both a technical onboarding process and a legal agreements onboarding process. Staff has been working hard to resurrect our state-level trust agreement. That is the rules of the road for exchanging data on a statewide basis. And when we start working directly with our local HIEs on that, we'll go about looking through those documents together. And then the last is engaging with data subscribers, which the primary audience of that would be our Medicaid managed care organizations. But it does say and other data subscribers, just to account for the fact that hospitals and providers can also be direct subscribers of this data. Ideally, though, the model that we're talking about is, you know, getting this ADT data up to the state level. The MCOs are the primary subscribers of that data, and they are forwarding those alerts to the providers and hospitals within their network. And that's something that is in their best interest to do as the payer, because they want better coordination of care. So even though, you know, we may not have hospitals and providers as the primary audience of that, ideally they are still very much getting that data.
Paula Anthony, what data sources are you contemplating for the MPI?
That is a very good question. Eric Heflin and I were just talking about that before the board meeting, and you know, I don't want to step on his toes, so I'll let him answer that for you.
Thank you, Eric Heflin. So the MPI is pretty flexible, so it can take probably any high-quality data source and successfully turn that into a master patient index system. But the highest quality data sources we've identified for this project so far are directly to obtain what's called an eligibility file from HHSC directly, and to augment that with an equivalent file from the MCOs.
Exactly what I was thinking. So any other questions or comments on issue spotting as we move from the test environment into the production environment for the Eden system? No? Okay. In that case, we can move to slide 13, which doesn't have a number on there, but it's the update on Texas Medicaid HIE IAPD, which all of that stands for Texas Medicaid Health Information Exchange Implementation Advanced Planning Document, which is why we just say IAPD. The purpose of an IAPD is to provide match funding from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to implement health information exchange projects and programs at the state level. This generally comes with a 90-10 match from the federal level. That does fall to somewhere short of a 90% match in instances where more than the Medicaid population is being benefited. Currently, our current project contract with Texas Medicaid is under the IAPD that originated October 1, 2017 and ran through September 30, 2019. So these IAPDs come in two-year implementations. So the good news is the point we're at now is CMS has approved the 2019 to 2021 IAPD. And that is really as much as we know right now. What also has to happen is it needs to go through some internal processing at Texas Medicaid, and then Texas Medicaid would need to amend the contract with THSA for us to be able to implement those projects and programs contained in this updated IAPD. So one thing I will say is we have already signed one amendment with them, and that was a simple extension of time that extended our contract, which previously terminated on September 30th, 2019. It now extends to September 30th, 2021. And it was very clear this amendment is just for extension of time, not for anything else. So a second amendment, you know, should be forthcoming. We didn't have it just quite in time for the board meeting today, but I do imagine that will occur in the near future. And we'll be able to provide updates at that time exactly what's in this IEPD and that contract just as soon as we're laying eyes on that. Any questions or comments about that? No? Okay. Then members, if you'll turn to slide 15, the next item of our HIE update is an update on the Patient Unified Lookup System for Emergencies, otherwise known as PULSE. And the purpose of PULSE is to provide a statewide standardized mechanism for disaster response volunteers and others that are turning up and volunteering in disaster environments to remotely and securely access patients' electronic health information in shelter environments during natural disasters. So we're currently working with key stakeholders and exploring the development of the PULSE system. Another thing I will mention is, as I mentioned earlier, this is included in the state health IT strategic plan. So Medicaid is very much planning around partnering with THSA for PULSE as laid out in that draft plan. If you'll turn to your next slide, slide 16, just an update that we had in the more near term about that is we had a bit of weather about a month and a half ago. Tropical storm Imelda appeared really out of nowhere, and then suddenly we had flooding in the greater Houston area again. And we had a very generous offer from our counterparts in California. We all take part in the National PULSE Advisory Board, along with a handful of other states, and our counterparts at the Sequoia Project at the national level. California did offer for Texas to be able to utilize California's PULSE platform in response to Imelda, which, again, very gracious of them. We were just not expecting that to happen, so we dropped everything that we were working on and went through the planning of, like, okay, let's say we need this to happen tomorrow. What do we need to put in place? So we worked with California about what would need to happen from a technical perspective. They would have needed to essentially take their platform, drop all of their California interfaces from that platform, and we would utilize that platform here in Texas, connect our interfaces to that platform, and even on top of that, we would need to come up with a plan for authenticating users of that platform, which more than likely would have needed to be somewhat of a manual process given the short amount of time that we were working with. And then from a legal and governance perspective, what we needed to do was, in the short term, the quickest connection we would be able to make would be to the eHealth Exchange that would get us the most statewide connections at the time, which we were previously a participant in the eHealth Exchange, but we terminated that agreement known as the DERSA, the Data Use Reciprocal Support Agreement, at the end of 2017. So they were also a very valuable resource. They got on the phone with me in under 45 minutes and were fully prepared to go through each and every single step of what we would need to do within 24 hours to resurrect all of those agreements on a temporary basis and become a member of the eHealth Exchange again. And they said, you know, we need to worry about these agreements right now. We can, you know, process any needed payments or any other steps at a later date. But essentially, we did have a working plan to be able to resurrect all of this within a 24-hour period, which is, really speaks to this community that is supporting the PULSE system and how they really just want to help people in a time of need. Usually all those other issues fall by the wayside. what happened after that was, we were in the middle of a disaster. So what we were trying, and Governor Abbott had declared a disaster, and we had our state authorities and local authorities working to respond to that disaster. There were shelters set up across greater southeast Texas. And what we really realized was that, one, we tried to get in direct contact with each of these shelters. There were about 15 that we could locate in the near term, and we attempted to contact 10 to 12 of them and could not get in contact with any of them, and it's more than likely because they were a tad busy actually providing services in their shelters. But what was the turning point that made us decide that now was not the time to be able to do this was that there was an order issued to not go to shelter environments, but if you were able to stay in your homes. And that told us that we were going to have a fraction of the shelter population that we did, say, for Hurricane Harvey a couple years ago. What we found out after the fact is that we had, I believe it was less than 1,200 people in shelters for less than 24 hours. So we had a plan to be able to start this system up within 24 hours. And, the plan is the easy part. Once we actually put, rubber to the road on that and got working, it would be, again, quite a feat to pull it off in 24 hours. And given the sparse shelter population and the fact that they were not going to be there for a very long time, we said this was not the time to move forward with this. But just know that, if this natural disaster scenario occurs, that we have help. Now it's being incorporated as a part of this state HIT plan. So there will be much more planning ahead of the next hurricane season to where we won't have to just, figure out what we're going to do in real time. But just wanted to share that update about what was going on in the background in response to Tropical Storm Imelda. Hit that and announce your name, yes, because we're just audio today.
Okay. Carlos DeVito, Houston, Texas. My question to you, George, is did you, through this experience, being kind of like involved with some of our patients in the area, in Houston actually and in Beaumont as well, did y'all have an idea of what kind of trigger point as far as people that you would say is relevant to activate the system?
So that is a very good question, and that's something we were trying to figure out in real time. What are the exact circumstances when we determine, all right, we're going to have, 500 people in the shelter for this many days. Does that justify turning it on? And that just really lends itself to one of the most important things that we have moving forward is a governance process. What entities are we working with at the state level and the local level, and what factors and guidelines are we using to determine that we need this system in this circumstance? It's very easy to say during Hurricane Harvey, we needed it because it was such a high volume of patients located, a lot of them condensed within very large shelter environments for extended periods of time. It was easy to say in this circumstance that because it's a lot of smaller shelters that are spread out and there's going to be less people there for shorter periods of time that, no, we shouldn't have. But putting in place proper guidelines to make that call is going to be one of the biggest, most central components that we have moving forward.
I'm Lourdes Cuellar, Houston. A question being, I'm speaking on behalf of the Texas Medical Center and I'm thinking of Harvey. And hospitals, I can tell you, speaking for the directors of pharmacy for all the hospitals and medical center, we were inundated with patients wanting refills because so many of the retail stores are closed. And they come and say, I want my blue pill for blood pressure, whatever. And connecting with the hospitals is really important, not only for the medical care, but what we get the most of. I mean, it's hundreds of people that come. And because the retails are closed and, you have to ask a lot of questions and not having access to some of the retail components, you really have to do some be very careful to when dispensing, but it really is a very large volume. So I don't know if the hospital systems are in your connectivity or your span, but I would highly encourage it, especially
right.
that in the emergency rooms.
This is another very good question, and based on another very good conversation I had with Eric right before the board meeting, and he's going to tell you more about it.
Great comment, by the way. This is Eric, Eric Heflin. So the thing we learned from Katrina, going back to those days, which I had the honor of being having some involvement personally, medication history was the single number one priority as far as displaced citizens, as far as providing health care to them. So that's indeed built into PULSE. As is other information such as current allergies, current medications, problems, and it included information such as advanced directives, the current vital signs, demographic information, and it also includes care team information so we know, for example, who has been involved in treating that patient over time. So it's designed to be a pretty complete record, providing more than adequate information for the providers actually securely accessing that information.
Hey, do we have any other questions, comments, or thoughts on the PULSE update?
James had one more question. So how prepared do you think we will be next hurricane season, or is there a timeline to get us there?
Right. Hurricane season, you know, happens in the latter part of the year, and even within hurricane season, there's much greater odds that we'll have a hurricane occur, but I believe between August 1 and October 30th is the highest probability time. So I think someone used the sports analogy in one of the last meetings that we're at. They're like, we need spring training, and quite literally, spring training would be part of it. You know, identifying who are the primary users of this system, not just the disaster response volunteers maintained by DSHS, but other people who come and utilize the system, and you know, working on building out that system, training people on the system, security measures for access to the system, having that locked down in the most efficient way possible while still providing access to the people who need to use it to help patients during these times. There's all things that we're going to be working on, you know, starting very soon, and we will be prepared for the next hurricane season. And we have the good fortune of learning a lot of lessons from our counterparts in California, because they obtained a grant from ONC and CMS, I believe, at least just ONC, a few years ago, and they piloted this system in response to their wildfires. And unfortunately for California, they've needed to continue to use this system in response to their wildfires. And we've been working with the National PULSE Advisory Board to learn lessons from other states. We also learned that Florida just had PULSE approved in their IEPD. Not that every single state can't have some form of natural disaster, but I would say that California and Texas and Florida are three of the biggest states, literally and figuratively, when it comes to natural disasters that need to be prepared. So we've been doing a lot of legwork already. It's going to be building out the system, training users on the system, and securing the system are going to be the most important aspects that we're going to be concentrating on moving forward. And we do anticipate being ready by the next hurricane season. Any other questions or comments? Yes.
Gloria Bryant, my question is that, will this system be able to, will we open it up for our neighboring state like Louisiana if there's a disaster and people are coming over?
That is a very good question. So part of the answer to that question is that the networks that we connect to for this system are at the local, state, and national levels. And some of those national networks that we would connect to would be the eHealth Exchange and Commonwealth and Care Quality Implementers. And when we plug into those systems, we are plugging into data sources in other states. So what would really need to happen is some of those other states would need to either also adopt the Pulse system, so they would be connected to us likewise, or essentially, and Eric, correct me if I'm wrong on this, because we would become a care quality implementer, a node on the eHealth Exchange, we would be another data source for perhaps hospital systems or HIEs in those states connected to it to be able to draw data from in the event of their own natural disaster.
This is Eric. It's probably key to understand that Pulse's intended use is in the field. It's in locations where patients are normally not seen. If, for example, patients in Texas were displaced to neighboring states, and those neighboring states were not impacted by the disaster at hand, they would use the normal EMRs through Care Quality, Health Exchange, Commonwealth, and others to access the patient records here in Texas and other places that are also connected. So Pulse's primary use cases, for example, in hospitals or tents or stadiums where patients are being treated out in the field where there actually is no normal physician EMR available for them to log into, if that helps clarify.
Thank you. Very good question, Victoria, and thank you, Eric. Any other questions or comments? Okay.
Thank you for that. Appreciate it.
Do you have your mic on?
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for all that interaction, guys. We appreciate that. Is there any further discussion? With that, our next item today is the update of from THSA CEO George Gooch on Secure Texas certification. Mr. Gooch, would you please brief the members on this item?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, if you'll turn to slide 18 in your board presentation slides, this will be a pretty brief update. So essentially, just a little background, THSA is charged with providing a voluntary certification for Texas-covered entities to certify their past compliance with state and federal medical privacy and security law. This was embedded in Texas House Bill 300 in 2011, and the benefit of having this certification is that if you have our certification and you are found in violation of the Texas Medical Records Privacy Act, then you get to use that as a mitigating factor for any civil or administrative penalties that are brought against you for violation of that act. So I was really hoping the last board meeting, I said we got one that's just on the cusp of finishing certification. That one has continued to be on the cusp, but the good news is that since that time, we had another entity start certification, and they have actually finished the certification process. The only thing that has stopped short of us awarding certification is they need to, we just sent an invoice to them for payment for services. They need to pay it, and then we send them their certificate and their letter outlining the parameters and scope of their certification, which lasts for a period of 2 years. Again, I really wish I could have been in a position to let you know more specifics about that at this board meeting, but now we're right on the cusp for two different entities that are obtaining certification. Any questions or comments on Secure Texas? Okay.
Any further discussion? Members, our next item today is the update from THSA CEO George Gooch on the updates to HIE Texas privacy and security policies and procedures. Mr. Gooch, could you please brief items on this, brief members on this item?
Thank you, Madam Chair. First and foremost, my apologies for sending you a 200-page attachments document. The privacy and security policies and procedures make up 130 of those 200 pages, and it's important that they all be included. We're not making very big changes, but we are making changes throughout the policies and procedures. And again, we'll get to this later. Another 40-some-odd pages of that is our state health IT plan. So that's like 175 of the 200 pages are those two documents. So if you'll look on slide 20 of your slides, and then also attachment number one, PDF page 2 of your attachments document, you'll see our proposed amendments to our privacy and security policies and procedures. And just a little background, the Texas Health Services Authority operates HIE Texas, the state-level health information exchange platform for the state. Because we utilize patient health data in the form of protected health information flows through that system, we do need privacy and security policies and procedures that comply with state and federal medical privacy and security law. We originally adopted these policies and procedures before we launched our first platform in 2013. We are about to develop a new platform today, so that requires some updating since our original platform. We also, in May of this year, signed a contract with the State Health and Human Services Commission, and one of the attachments to that was the HHS Data Use Agreement, which is an all-encompassing business associated agreement and other data uses, what you can and can't do for uses and disclosures of health information, if something goes wrong, in the event of a breach, who do you notice and within what timeline. We needed to update our privacy and security policies and procedures to ensure very clearly that we are in compliance with that data use agreement as well. And then one final note that I didn't put on the slide here, but it is contained in the policies and procedures. There was some legislation passed this past Texas legislative session. Texas House Bill 4390 made updates to our state-level breach notification law contained in Chapter 521 of the Texas Business and Commerce Code. So those three things combined result in some of these amendments, and not that I'm sure that you guys didn't spend all last weekend and all this week reading very thoroughly through all of these policies and procedures as a whole, but in addition to that work that you did, we also provided a summary of the changes on the following slides that we will go through at a high level. And then we'll vote on at the end of that. So if you'll look at slide 21, we'll start, these first three slides will be amendments to our privacy policies and procedures. Each of these policies and procedures break down into different articles. So Article 1 is introduction. We removed reference to our prior HIE platform and added references to the Texas Data Use Agreement. Within the definition section, we added, again, those same two items, removed references to the prior platform, added references to the data use agreement. We adjusted definitions of health information exchange as those have changed in statute since we originally passed these policies and procedures. And we had amended the definition of workforce to more closely align with the HIPAA definition. For the privacy officer, we generalized the contact info for that. We used to very specifically point to our general counsel, who is no longer with us, but instead we have a more general contact information for a privacy officer. For the next three articles, consent authorization, patient preference, and notice of data practices, there are no amendments. For our accounting of disclosures, there's reference to a privacy officer, which we generalize the contact information for, and then there's no amendment to the access amendment and copying article. Any questions on those before we move to the next slide? Then if you look on slide 22, we made no amendments to Articles 9 and 10 on requirements for restrictions in workforce training. Article 11 on receiving complaints, we changed the contact info for privacy officer. We made no amendments to the sanctions policy. For our business associate agreement policy, under Article 14, we removed reference to the THSA general counsel. Article 15 on documentation amendment, no amendments. Article 16, breach notification under HIPAA, we replaced general counsel with privacy officer. Any questions on the items on slide 22 before we move on? Slide 23, the very first item, and I will go over this just a little bit more in detail, is sensitive personal information breach notification, and this is our state law breach notification in line with recently passed legislation. So essentially what this legislation does is it states that instead of making notification to individuals as quickly as possible, is what the old language was, it puts a 60-day timeline within a reasonable period and no later than 60 days, and this brings it more in line with other similar statutes. But then it also states that if you have a breach of information that includes more than 250 Texas residents, you have to make a separate disclosure to the Texas Attorney General. And not only that, it lists five specific categories of information of what you have to disclose to the Attorney General. And then finally, there are very specific guidelines under the HHS data use agreement for how and when we notify HHS of a breach of information, and we have included all of those as amendments to this policy. For permitted uses and disclosures under the next article, we amended the description of HIE Texas to align with our current statute, added reference to the data use agreement. Under the minimum necessary policy, similar as above, but we also replaced general counsel with privacy officer. For workforce training log, that's an appendix. We deleted it, and we're going to replace it at a later date with our own form that we currently use. And then for the next appendix, we generalize contact information for privacy officer. That brings us to the end of our updates to the privacy policies and procedures. Does anyone have any questions about that? Yes.
Hi, Emily Hartman. On the SPI breach notification policy, I noticed that the language for notifying HHSC says that you'll notify immediately upon discovery of a breach. Is there any way to make that more specific, like within 24 hours, so that y'all know what guideline to work within?
So that is a very good question. Immediately, you know, it's not as if, you know, someone is holding, you know, wearing a big sandwich board that says you've been breached and we know, and the first thing I do is pick up the phone and call HHSC to let them know. You know, there is a determination that a breach has in fact occurred. And, you know, we wouldn't idle on that either, because we likewise don't want our business associates to do this to us. As soon as you know that there is a breach for certain, you need to notify. So there is a knowledge component that goes along with that. It wouldn't be that a security incident occurs and then you notify, but it's when you know, or you reasonably should have known, that there is a breach, that's when you notify. I would be in favor of putting more specifics around this, but what I would want to do first is probably work in collaboration with the HHS privacy officer or others to talk about what they would be comfortable with in the reporting mechanisms for that.
Paula Anthony, and I'm probably preaching to the choir, but as you know, oftentimes a very long period of time can pass between when the breach occurs and when you actually know it occurs. I mean, there have been some staggering reports of years going by before that information becomes public knowledge, or even private knowledge to the individual or the company that was subject and victim to the breach. So it is a tricky thing on this breach notification, because you have to know. And there's whole arguments about whether or not you should have known earlier. That's a whole different conversation about whether an organization should have the controls in place such that they should know that a breach has occurred. But at least thus far, across the world, it is still a big challenge to know when, in fact, some of these breaches, which are very sophisticated, when, in fact, they're happening.
Very good comment. And, you know, it is a little bit more challenging even when we're talking about, you know, the SPI breach notification, because it is based on state law. They don't have an analysis of what constitutes a breach under state law. They have a definition for what is a breach of system security, but under HIPAA, there's a four-factor analysis to follow to determine whether something is or is not a breach. So we don't have that analysis here at the state level. And there's not a lot of guidance for enforcement at the state level. The only one that really comes to mind was the Uber case last year, and that was a multi-state enforcement, and that was pretty clear-cut because what had happened was the prior administration over at Uber had hackers place ransomware and told them, if you pay us X amount of dollars, then this whole problem goes away. And they paid those dollars, and the problem went away until they got a new CEO who came in and was informed, hey, this happened last year. And then he said, like, well, who did we notify? And they said, well, no one. So then at that point, they notified. So that's an example of when it's pretty clear you did know. But beyond that, there are much more, you know, layers of gray in between a security incident to a breach. And yeah, a lot of times you may not even know yourself. Unfortunately, for a lot of the larger organizations, the Anthem breach, for example, the only reason they find out is because they work for organizations that are large and sophisticated enough to find out that they did in fact have a breach. A lot of smaller entities, they may never know. The knowledge component is a key factor in that. Yes, Eric.
Thank you. Just to elaborate on that too, about your point about organizations should having known a breach occurred, we actually follow for our deployment something called NIST 853, and that includes a large number of security controls, and that was publicly vetted to create that standard. And so security experts worldwide and countrywide have collaborated on helping to create it. And so part of the reason we leverage that is because it includes controls, including detecting what's called an indication of compromise early, detecting if your computers have been actually breached in any way as well early in the process. And so we're very rigorously trying to adhere to all known best practices as far as the actual technical deployment.
Thank you, Eric. Very good comment. If there are no other questions or comments on the privacy policies and procedures, we'll quickly move through the security policies and procedures and the amendments there too. Members, if you'll turn to slide 24, you'll see very similar for both our introduction and updates, introduction and definition policies and procedures. We remove references to our prior platform, added references to the data use agreement. You're going to see a lot of amendments in here that are non-substantive edits, and that is almost entirely we have changed EPHI, which stands for electronic protected health information, an uppercase E to a lowercase E. So when you see non-substantive edits, that's all that is. We made no amendments to the documentation requirements. For the security officer, we again generalize the contact information, although Eric is our acting security officer. For the management process, we supplemented our own requirements in our risk analysis process and made other non-substantive edits. For workforce security, information access management, and security awareness, we made non-substantive edits to each of those. If you'll turn to slide 25, for security incidents, we made no amendments. For contingency planning, we amended regarding disconnected backups, and then made other non-substantive edits. For evaluation and audit, as well as vendor contracts, we made non-substantive edits. For facility access control, we made non-substantive edits and updates to our floor plan, and this is because we have moved offices and switched vendors since the time that we originally created these policies and procedures. For workstation security, no amendments. For device and media control, we narrowed the scope of this policy to those systems containing EPHI. Before, even though more globally for the introduction policy and procedure, it made clear that this relates to those systems that contain EPHI. It didn't point specifically to that in the policy. Outside of those systems that contain EPHI, we prohibit use of mobile devices when accessing, storing EPHI. And the point of that is We don't have many people that work here, so there's no reason that we need people. There's really no reason any immediate staff need to access electronic protected health information, let alone do that on a mobile device, as that is year after year, the highest incident of breach is a lost laptop. So any system that someone would access EPHI from has to be a system that is not mobile.
Paula, Anthony, do you ever have a case where email is used as a transport mechanism, even internally within your organization, that includes or could include EPHI? And I know that's a very broad question.
Yeah. Thank you for that question. No, is the short answer. In addition, to build on what George was just or Mr. Gooch was just explaining, the EPHI environment is completely segregated from the general business environment, and so emails are not even allowed to transit that barrier. And that reduces an entire risk vector just by eliminating mobile devices. Essentially, you know, back to my prior comment about adhering to NIST 853, we've eliminated entire classes of risks by our approach, such as prohibiting laptops or mobile devices or Wi-Fi-based access to even get access to PHI-based content.
You don't have the fabulous problem that all of us in hospitals have where you're have any number of employees that will type in EPHI into an email and send it to someone.
We have the luxury of an environment that really is completely self-contained just for this purpose of transacting PHI content. And so that does not, you know, we don't have a complex environment such as a hospital or agency where you have to intermingle on a daily basis, you know, different types of content. So our PHI environment is a completely isolated environment. So no, we don't, luckily don't have that problem.
Very good comment. Thank you. And then finally, technical access controls, no substantive edits. And then if you'll move to slide 26, we made no amendments to audit controls. We made non-substantive edits to integrity controls. For authentication controls, we amended our background check process to strengthen that beyond what it was in 2013. And then for transmission security, we amended the process for password encryption, added requirements for two-factor authentication, and other non-substantive edits. Are any questions on the security policies and procedures and the amendments there too?
Emily Hartman. On the background checks, is there any thought to doing those at regular intervals in addition to upon hire?
Yes, very good question, and that is our plan at this time. After we, fingers crossed, adopt this, or even if we don't adopt it, we're going to do additional background checks because it's a good time to do it. We're rebuilding a new platform and moving into a new service line, so ensuring that we do that on a regular basis is always a best practice, and we're going to do it.
Any further discussion? Is there a motion to approve the amendments of the HIE Texas privacy and security policies and procedures as laid out before the board?
So moved.
Second.
There are motion and seconded. Those in favor say aye.
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 Those approved?
Opposed.
Opposed. Sorry. The motion passes. Are there any further discussions in this whole section? Thank you. Members, our next item today is an update from THSA's CEO, George Gooch, on the THSA Collaboration Council. Mr. Gooch, would you please brief the members on this item?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, if you'll turn to slide 28 in your board presentation slides, you'll see an update on the THSA Collaboration Council. So THSA has always had a collaboration council, and we have actually always had task forces that are subcomponents of this collaboration council. After we moved away from our prior platform, we technically moved these to meeting on an ad hoc basis. But without a platform and without hefty planning in the term thereafter, you know, there wasn't a lot to add or to hoc. So we essentially have not met with that council for a while, but we are going to resurrect that now so we have a strong governance process in place as we move forward with these new services. So the primary role of the Collaboration Council is to advise the THSA Board of Directors and staff and develop consensus among key stakeholders on the planning and implementation of statewide health information exchange. THSA staff shall assign tasks to this council. So as you'll see here, we have a list of membership on this council, and we also have an article on the news and events page of our website where people can go to fill out the form to apply to be on this council. Even though technically the council didn't go away, a lot of the people who were originally involved in it in the beginning have moved on to other jobs or are no longer actively engaged. So we're going through the application process again. So, you know, the real key aspect of this is there are a lot of different stakeholders who make up the health information exchange environment, and they don't always have the same end goals or aspirations associated with HIE. So to the greatest extent possible, we want to work all that out and get on the same page, lowest common denominator that we can amongst these stakeholders. And the Collaboration Council serves that purpose. And the way this governance essentially goes is that this council will meet on a quarterly basis, and it'll be webinar-based. It's going to be run by our VP for External Affairs, Stephen Raines, and they will obtain input from stakeholders on statewide HIE, and we will report back on that to the board each of these quarterly board meetings. So that way the board, these governor appointees sitting up here today, will be better advised by hearing from the private sector exactly how they feel statewide HIE should operate, in addition to the other governance structures that we have in place, such as being subject to Open Meetings Act and having the wonderful audience that we do have here in place today. Again, because we're audio only, we're in a very large room that is packed end to end. A few hundred people, I believe, are here today. You might hear from a couple of them, but they're all sitting on the edge of their seats. With that, actually, if you'll see on slides 28 and 29, it makes up the membership. We have ex officio membership from other organizations. And this is something that, you know, we have put together for a number of years now, and we are going to actively reach out to all of these organizations. But again, just like anything else that we do, and because this is webinar-based, you know, all members of the public are allowed to join those webinars and participate. And if someone is interested in joining, please do let us know. Go to the website, fill out an application. Really, we plan to have this up and active and have our first meeting in advance of our February board meeting next year. Do we have any questions or comments on the Collaboration Council?
No further discussion. We're moving on now to organizational business and reports and updates. The first item is the consideration of the minutes of the August 16th, 2019 board meeting. This is an action item, which will be available for review on attachment to PDF page 138 in your attachment documents. Is there a discussion? Anyone have discussion on that? Is there a motion to approve the minutes as laid out before the board?
And I so moved.
Second.
All right. Our next item is the consideration and approval of amendments to the THSA's proposed fiscal year 2020 budget. The proposed budget is available in Attachment 3. That's PDF page 141 in your attachments document. Mr. Gooch, could you please brief the members on this item?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if you'll turn to the next page, even slide 142 is where we have the substantive information. This is the budget that we approved at the August board meeting of this year. So the far right-hand column is what is currently in place. As you'll see, there are a couple asterisks associated with passage of that budget, most notably on the health information exchange line item. We told you at that time that we knew that there were more factors forthcoming, and those factors relate heavily to the implementation, approval, and passage of the IAPD. So the situation that we're in right now, as we described earlier, is that that IAPD has been approved, but what we still need is for that to go through approval, again, at the state level through Texas Medicaid, and then they need to amend our contract. So we're not quite in a position yet to amend our budget in alignment with the items that are contained in the IAPD. However, the challenge that we have is we have, due to scheduling, we're meeting at the very beginning of this month. Our first meeting next year will happen at the very end of that month. So we're looking at a solid 4 months, you know, between today and February 28th. So in the event that we need to spend more funds that are currently contained in that budget, we want to be prepared to do so. And just to be clear, I would like to propose that we amend this budget formally at the February board meeting when we have that more information in front of us. But if we need to build out infrastructure or other services in excess of the amount listed here in front of you, we want to be prepared. And so what the motion is before the board, and the Madam Chair will make the motion, is for the board chair and finance chair to have to approve any amounts over what's listed in that current line item. And that's how the board will continue to have input and oversight. And that would, again, just really take place between now and February in the event that we need to spend more than what is listed. So that's kind of the background of how we got to this point.
Thank you, Mr. Gooch. Are there any discussions on this matter? Everyone's okay? is there a motion to approve the board chair and finance chair to approve funds for HIE needed in excess of what's in the current budget until the budget is amended? Thank you. The motion has been made and seconded. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion passes. Thank you. Moving on, our next item is the consideration and approval of the THSA's financial statements through September 30th, 2019. The financial statements are available as attachment number 4, PDF page 143, in your attached documents. Mr. Sandstrom Hill, could you please brief the members on the financial statements?
Yes, this is Jonathan Sandstrom Hill. I'll do a brief overview and then see if there's any questions. A couple of things to note: the on page 144, there's a significant amount of 144. There's a significant amount of accounts receivable. That's unpaid HHSC invoices that were submitted right at the end of the fiscal year. So that's not an indication of an ongoing problem. It's just a timing issue here. If you look at the statements of revenue on page 146, revenue expenses and change of assets, a couple things to note here. One, there's a bunch of revenue, which is good. That's a function of getting paid by HHSC for meeting the milestone goals George discussed earlier in the meeting. So that's a lot of progress, which is great. Also to note, just in general on this page, the federal grant-related activity column is likely to get taken out of future financial statements just due to the fact that there's not a lot of federal grant-related activity going on right now. So for simplicity, that's likely to get taken out. I'm not sure when, but in the future.
Next board meeting.
If you flip to the current, page 147, you'll note here, this is just a comparison to our actual budget. You'll see that for expenses, we're under budget in not almost every category, so that's good management. Good job, George. And other than that, that's really the update, so I'm happy to answer any questions. I'm sure George is also happy to answer any questions as well about these financial statements.
Deshpande, I just have a question around what a particular line item represents. What does state shared services mean?
So I'll field to that one. That's a very good question. Essentially, that is what is now described as health information exchange. In our current budget that we looked at the item just before we went to the financial statements, we used to call them state level shared services under our prior platform, but now we're just switching to call it, you know, state level health information exchange for simplicity. That line item will be renamed, and probably another, just for consistency of these financial statements, we've kept some older line items in here that we probably also need to take out, such as, white space exchange education and marketing was a holdover from a specific budget category under our prior contract, not this contract, with HHSC funds that needed to be expended for compliance with that contract. So we'll remove that moving forward as well. Very good catch, and something I meant to mention earlier. My apologies.
Any other discussion? Thank you, Mr. Gooch. Thank you, Mr. Sandstrom. Is there a motion to approve the financial statements as laid out before the board?
So moved.
I'll second.
It has been moved and seconded. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion passes. Members, our next item is an update in the THSA's annual report to the legislature and governor. Mr. Gooch, could you brief the members on this item?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, if you'll turn to slide 38 of your board presentation slides, you'll see here we have a statutory requirement pursuant to section 182.106 of the Texas Health and Safety Code to submit an annual report to the governor, the lieutenant governor, the Speaker of the House, and the appropriate oversight committees in the Senate and House of Representatives, which we have always made actually specifically under rule. It is House Public Health Committee, and then we also submitted to the Senate Health and Human Services in the Senate. The annual report must include financial information and a progress update of the THSA's effort to carry out its mission. We have one document that is the substantive body of the report, and then we have the findings of our annual audit that includes that financial information. Those two documents together make up our compliance with Section 182.106. This is just to update you that staff will be working on that annual report between this board meeting and the next board meeting in February. And then just to give you a preview of the next year, because these are legislative reports that we turn in, we'll actually have that one ready for approval at the November board meeting next year in advance of when the legislature convenes in the following January. So we will actually have a shorter amount of time between annual reports for this year and next year, but we will be working on that, and we'll have a final document for you to review and approve at the February board meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Peach. Any discussion? Moving to the next item. This is an update on the State Health Information Technology Plan. Mr. Gooch, could you brief the members on this item?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, this is a rather lengthy document, and I have a high degree of confidence you've all read and memorized it. In addition to that, we have also provided an overview on slide number 40 in your board presentation slides. So just as a background, CMS recently approved the Medicaid 1115 waiver extension, and I should have that word extension in here, my apologies. A portion of that waiver requires the Texas Health and Human Services Commission to develop a health IT strategic plan related to activities that will link services and core providers across the continuum of care to the greatest extent possible using health IT initiatives and strategies. Now, this is a draft plan, a copy of which is available for review as attachment number 5, PDF page 148 in your attachments document. I just wanted to bring this up because the Texas Health Services Authority's state-level health information exchange platform, known as HIE Texas, is a core component of this draft plan. So we are mentioned throughout the document, and very specifically, the references to THSA include our current work under the IAPD, including the Eden Project, a background on the THSA's role historically when we were created, and our Chapter 182, our enabling statute, reference to partnership with the Health and Human Services Commission, Medicaid, DSHS, and other state agencies, a reference to the THSA state HIE plan, which I'll discuss more in a moment, a background on PULSE and partnership between HHSE and THSA to operate the PULSE system, and a timeline of health IT legislation, a lot of that relevant to the history of legislation for the THSA. So HHSE has requested stakeholder feedback on this document no later than November 9th, and I know what you're all thinking. You're looking at your calendars. My gosh, that's a Saturday, so I should be ready to do this probably by November 8th. THSA does intend to provide comments on this, but because we are, you know, the subject of the document, our comments are going to be wholly neutral and only providing, you know, support and background in any specific areas. Just one additional item that I wanted to touch on and is included in this next steps here. Staff is recommending that we review and update our state HIE plan to align with this health IT strategic plan. So background on the HIE plan, Texas submitted their HIE plan to the Office of National Coordinator for Health Information Technology, otherwise known as ONC, in 2010. And that was the beginning of the state HIE cooperative agreement program when the federal government gave out funds to states to implement their health information exchange infrastructures. And that went hand in hand with the meaningful use program incentive funding for healthcare eligible providers and hospitals to adopt EHR technology. So that plan that we Texas, through HHSE, turned into ONC was basically us telling the federal government, here is how we intend for health information exchange to operate in the state of Texas. And THSA is responsible for managing this plan. So we still have that. It is on the HIE page of our website. It was originally passed in 2010. This board, after a stakeholder engagement process, updated that plan in 2014, which was the end of that grant program, and it was really to represent, like, hey, here's where the HIE market is shifting now that it's 4 years have passed. We're now 5 years past that. It's 2019, almost 2020, and there's still more planning going on from our, you know, state and federal government partners. And being a public-private partnership, we are designed to, you know, be that bridge between the public and private sectors. That's why we partner with the Health and Human Services Commission and other state agencies at the state level, and that's why we partner with our local health information exchanges and other entities on the private side of the equation. And we offer a platform to be able to exchange data between the public and private sectors and, you know, beyond state borders, et cetera. So this is a rather significant plan that's being proposed here in its draft form that will become final at some point after November 9th, I'm sure. So we want to make sure that our state HIE plan is in alignment with what gets passed here. So what staff is proposing is that we will take our current state HIE plan and we will amend it to align with the state HIT plan, and for this board to be able to formally adopt those amendments at the February board meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Gooch. Any discussion? Thank you. The board will meet again on February 28th, 2020. As you'll see on slide 42, the board has set the quarterly meetings for the 2020 calendar year. As noted, the board will conduct its business and biennial public hearings on, one, the state and Privacy and Cybersecurity on May 15th, and 2 on the state's interoperability on August 21st. Do members have any questions or comments about the meeting schedule?
Yes. Roya Bryant. November 1st is a Sunday?
Yes.
Did I read it wrong?
It's supposed to be 13th.
Madam Chair, this is George Gucci. You very much did not read it wrong. One of your staff members, could have been me, could have been someone else, forgot to put the 3 in there. And it's Friday, November 13th is how that should read.
November 13th. Friday the 13th at work.
Yes.
Thank you for that catch. Any other comments or questions? Do members have any items they would like to have included in the next meeting agenda?
Do what? Can I make one more comment?
Who does?
Can I just?
Yeah. Sure. Of course. George has
another and just another item of note on there that I should have included in the notes. If you look at the bottom of slide 42, we're going to need to schedule a meeting of the Finance Committee to take place between this board meeting and the next board meeting. This is a result of updates to our our accounting and finance policies and procedure that this board made in April of last year that puts our finance committee in charge of reviewing our annual audit. That audit is going to occur from December 2nd through December 13th, another Friday the 13th, and they will provide a report back to staff. And then they will provide an overview of that to the Finance Committee. Probably sometime in January is when we'll reach out for this to occur. And then they'll provide the findings of that report to the full board at our February board meeting. So just a note that we still need to schedule that. We will be reaching out to members of the Finance Committee to plan that.
Thank you. Any other comments on the schedule? All right. Before we adjourn, I would like to ask if there's anyone that would like to provide a public comment at this time.
Fill in my form.
Excellent.
Madam Chair, George. Thanks for having me. I'm Phil Beckett. I'm the CEO with HASA, which is one of the regional not-for-profit private health information exchange that you referred to. And I just wanted to say, you know, we as HASA are full support of Texas Health Services Authority working together, how we stand up health information exchange, you know, across the whole state of Texas, working together. We're one of several of the HIEs here. We want to, you know, we as HASA want to see that done. It's so critical to patient care. I think the work that you're doing, that we're all doing, in terms of outcomes for patients, improving health, reducing costs, and applaud the work that you're doing. And I want to, you know, state that we fully support. We want to partner with you and do the right thing here for the health of Texans. So I just wanted to say that. Thank you.
Very much for you and HASA. Appreciate it. Any other public comment? Very good. I would like to thank everyone for a very productive meeting and congratulate the staff and what a great turn it's been in the last couple of years. We're really actually moving along very nicely, so congratulations to you. Is there a motion to adjourn the meeting of the Board of Directors of the Texas Health Services Authority?
Paula Anthony, so moved.
Roya Bryant, second.
Motion has been made and seconded. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion passes and the meeting is adjourned at... Oh,
no.
I thought you were saying so. 11:37.